From Utah Public Radio, this is Undisciplined. I'm Matthew Lamont. A while back on this program, we had a frank conversation about a tool intended to help people disagree better. It's called the Dignity Index. It's an 8-point scale for measuring how we talk to each other when we disagree. And it's based on the idea that contempt causes division. Now, I've been a big fan of this tool for a while now, and I've introduced it to students, to colleagues, to family members, to friends. But for myself and for others, I've noticed that there's a pretty big hurdle to getting people to think differently about the dignity they are offering to others. Because it's hard to offer dignity to other people when it feels like they are attacking your safety and even your very humanity. And Chris Campbell struggles with these feelings too. Chris was a recent Democratic candidate for the Utah State House. He's a parent of two daughters. He's a self-professed math nerd, and he's a man of faith. He's also transgender, and his opponent in that race was a legislator who had built a large part of her political identity on ideas and actions that Chris and other trans people have said will make their lives harder, less safe, less private, and less free. Chris is angry about all of this, and in a recent op-ed in the Salt Lake Tribune, he wrote that anger comes from a need for self-preservation, and that he's been tempted to respond instinctively. But instead, Chris did something, well, that was pretty radical. Again and again, both as a constituent and a political opponent to Representative Kira Berkland, he visited with her. They talked about water and healthcare and affordable housing and climate and agriculture and also sometimes about trans rights. It's unclear whether Chris's efforts will have an effect. Berkland won re-election handily, and then very shortly after the election, she resigned. But even if Berkland had stuck around, some people have questioned whether Chris's approach would have had much of an effect. And that includes some other trans people who have said that it's impossible to build bridges with people who don't think you have a right to exist. But Chris says he's still working every day to give dignity and respect to people who disagree with him, even those who are actively working to deny him the rights that he and other trans people have under the law right now. Chris Campbell, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Chris, some of this program's listeners might be a little confused right now. We usually focus on research and discovery on this show. But one of the reasons I reached out to you is because you're not just making an argument about principles. You've noted that if trans people and their supporters are going to change hearts and minds, that the research pretty clearly shows that's not going to happen if they're calling their opponents names or they're threatening their opponents, that they're acting in these kinds of like angry ways.
Yeah, correct. And also, you know, there's an understanding that if I think that this is an approach that people should be trying and that the research says is effective or is ineffective, then I need to look at myself first and try that out myself and put it into practice and see what works.
I'm wondering if part of the way you think about this comes from your background in human brain mapping. Like when you're thinking about how to act, when you're thinking about how you respond, do you like make a mental picture of what's happening in another person's brain?
You know, that's interesting. I haven't thought about it from that standpoint, but I have really looked at communication from many different angles throughout my career, whether that's looking at the brain wiring and how the brain communicates internally, or whether that's looking in computer networks and how we structure communication across various network systems, or whether that's looking at interpersonal communication or and group dynamics. I'm really interested in what is effective ways to communicate and to function and to understand.
Where did that come from, do you think? Like that part of your brain that says, I really want to understand how communication happens on all of these various different levels.
I think it comes from my own explorations as I've grown up and I've been trying to navigate the world and understand, you know, either what people are telling me or understand even myself and what I'm thinking. It's one thing to be told we need good communication. It's something else entirely to know what that good communication actually looks like. What is actually effective? How can I show up differently in a conversation? And so that's where my interest has really been, in studying and understanding what works for me.
And a lot of those studies have led you to this sort of fundamental understanding that when we disagree in very heated ways, that de-escalation is important. That's what the research says. But you know, Chris, like, the research tells us a lot of things, right? It tells us if we exercise more and we sleep better and we eat healthier, we'll be healthier people. We ignore all that research. And here, what you've called for is this sort of radical sort of grace, regardless of whether, like, the research says it would be better. It's really hard, right?
Yeah, it's absolutely hard. Just like knowing that you need to sleep doesn't mean that you automatically go to bed earlier. It takes an intentionality to put it into practice and to develop the skills over time. So I think part of my grace and willingness to give space for other people as I engage in conversation with them comes from my understanding that it's been a journey for me. It's taken time for me to learn how to show up in these ways. And I'm not perfect at it by any means, even after years of practice. But each time I get better and each time I have a reasonably successful conversation, I feel good at the end of that. The person I'm talking with feels good at the end of that. And that's enough of an indication that I'm on the right path, that I keep trying to improve even more how I show up. And what I find is that we often have a second opportunity, sometimes even a third opportunity, to make it right. So if we get something wrong our first time around, it's a little harder because it gets a little more awkward. And I find, like, I need to get more humble and apologize. Like, oh, sorry, that's not how I meant to show up in that. Let me try again. And let me do it this way and apologize and try again. And one of the things that I found is when I approach something like that, the other person I'm working with gives me the grace and understanding to hear that second time. So we don't have to be perfect that first time. When you give yourself grace and when you give the person you're with grace, they will often, not always, you can't expect it from them, but they will often return that to you.
You've also said that you have compassion for people who, when they feel under attack, they lash back. You've likened that to a fundamental survival impulse. This is evolutionary. It's biochemical, yeah?
We do know that there are instinctual responses around fight or flight, things like that, right? Those defensive mechanisms that we have. And those are very much psychological in nature. So when we're feeling emotionally attacked, that comes across as physical responses often to lash out in various ways, whether it's heated anger in words or, you know, other physical manifestations. So it's very much being aware of that psychological tendency that we all have as humans. It's part of being human.
And breaking that cycle when something is part of being human, that's hard. It's gotta be hard for you too. And in fact, you've said this isn't just a principle that you're practicing. You've likened it to a spiritual practice. Can you unpack that for me?
Yeah. And let me start by saying a little bit, some of these are the ideas like think fast, act slow. It takes me a while to process those emotions. It can take me several days to get from a state of being angry and upset to work through my emotions enough to where I can be calm enough to show up in a conversation around that thing. So one of the things that I've learned to do is give myself time in that moment. Now, as far as the spiritual practice part of it, a few years back, part of my own spiritual journey has been to show up at a church down the road from my house that's an evangelical church. And this was part of my fundamental understanding that I felt like people, to counter polarization, need to be interacting with people from other bubbles. That if we're in our own little bubble and not talking with somebody with different perspectives, then we're not going to develop understanding of each other. And so because I felt like people should do that, I said, well, then I need to do that first and see if that works and is a reasonable ask. And so that's part of one of many reasons why I started attending the church. And what's been really interesting about that experience is I get challenged by my faith to love my neighbors, to love myself, and to love my enemies. And sometimes the hardest part of that is loving myself, then loving neighbors can be tricky, and then learning to love your enemies, right? I look at the meta prayers where you wish somebody, you know, health or a good life, and it's easy to wish that of somebody that you like, but it's much harder to wish somebody who's been treating you poorly to have a good, happy life. For me, the spiritual practice often starts with somebody that I'm struggling with, for me to imagine wishing them to have a happy life. And when I can be in that spot, then it's much easier for me to see their humanity and then to talk with them, regardless of how they treat me.
Okay, so the evangelical movement is large and expansive, and so I don't want to make any assumptions here, but there is also a definitive and very large segment of evangelical Christians who have very much embraced homophobia and transphobia. Has that been your experience when you go to this church? And I guess I should maybe also start with the question of, like, do the people in that church understand that you're a trans man?
So one of the things that I realized is through my life experiences that I had formulated in my own mind. I was painting Christianity, I was painting evangelicals with a really broad stereotypical brush and assuming that they all thought and felt a certain way and that they would all treat me a certain way. And so part of my experience that has been profoundly healing for me to show up at this church is to realize that not every evangelical is like that stereotype in my mind. And in fact, most of them are not. That every person I've met at that church is vastly more complex and interesting and human than that picture that I had developed in my mind. So by learning that and by getting to know the people and to love them as individuals, even when I didn't agree with all of their views, because there are definitely plenty of people in the church that I don't agree with all of their views, it has been very healing to my soul to be able to see their humanity. Now, I started going to the church around the time that I started socially transitioning. I hadn't started medically transitioning until a few months after being in attendance, but I made it very clear from my time of first showing up to the church that I was going through the transition. It was very upfront. And was coming in because it's a private group. I didn't want to impose myself in the church and say, hey, here I am, you've got to accept me. That's just not appropriate for that situation. So I came in and said, you know, hey, here I am, I live down the road, I'd like to learn more about you, I want to see if there's room for me here. Is there space for me here? And I think that helped set some space for us to get to know each other.
Were there times that you felt, or where it was communicated to you, that maybe there wasn't room or there wasn't as much room as you were going to need to make those people part of your spiritual family?
Let me start by where there was room for me. I started by talking with some of the leadership team in the church and some of my very first conversations with them explaining who I was. You know, I just said, you know, here's who I am. I'm trans. I'm going through this transition. I want to see if there's space here. So I would tell them some of my journey. I was going to college in Laramie, Wyoming, when Matthew Shepard was killed. I was very, very, very much in the closet at the time. And I saw the Westboro Baptist Church come in with their hateful message. And I did not hear Christians speak up against that. And that's part of what had informed my understanding of how Christianity treats gay people or treats trans people. And again, I had unfairly painted with a broad brush all of Christianity as not treating people kindly. But I was sharing that with leadership at the church and had a couple different times, a couple different people apologize to me for the harm that the church and that Christians have caused to gay people over the years through that. And I was not expecting that. I wasn't asking for that apology. And it was amazingly healing when I received it. And that was a sign that there was maybe some room for some sort of ongoing conversation here. You know, there's a book that I read written by a Catholic priest who was talking about bridging between the LGBTQ community and the church. and the steps that need to take from both sides of that bridge to build that bridge. And so that's part of the intention that I brought into the church, was what is my role in building that bridge? And it was really interesting to see how the people I was talking with were able to also, from their end, start to put bricks in place on their side to build a bridge.
Has there been enough of a bridge built that, I mean, is this a place that you're going to continue going, that's going to continue being part of your journey?
Yes. You know, there's still a few little holes and planks and things that come up that we're working through. One of the things that has really developed over the past few years is my own understanding of my relationship with God. And so I ask God frequently, is this still where you want to have me? Is this still the right place for me? And there are moments sometimes where I'm like, maybe not. And when I ask that question, I get a very strong, yeah, this is still the right fit for me. And so I continue to go, even as there is some back and forth and some struggle about some things. For instance, my role in the kids ministry, whether or not it's appropriate for me to help teach the kids on Sunday mornings, has been a back and forth. Sometimes it's okay, sometimes it's not. And that's really hard to sit in when it's not okay, because I feel like I have a lot to offer and teach kids. And I know how long it takes me to change habits and how long it takes me to change my understanding of myself. And it would be unfair of me to expect somebody else to be faster than I am at that process. Humans take a while to change, to learn, to grow. And so I find myself learning patience.
I want to see if we can segue back to this relationship that you have with Representative Berkeland. I have to assume, Chris, it was hard enough to give grace and respect to her when she was engaging in words and actions that a lot of trans people, including yourself, have said were hurtful and were threatening. But then shortly after the election, she resigned, and now a very small number of Republican Party insiders are going to decide who gets that seat instead of the voters. It's got to feel sometimes like the limits of your grace are being tested, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, I might have more patience than a lot of people do, for better or for worse, you know. It can be challenging, right? Like, I had strong emotions when I found out about her resignation, partly because of the timing of it. It didn't seem fair to the voters to do that after the election instead of resigning beforehand, right? And so, again, in the moment, I have those strong feelings. I want to express them. But if I express them that way, then it's going to cause more harm than good. That's what I've realized. Even though it feels really good to let that out in the moment, often I realize it's not actually beneficial to me to do that. So I've learned to give myself the time to process and think through, okay, given these actions, what can I do? How can I show up in a way that is in my integrity and that helps to push for positive change for the community around me? You know, I want to be careful that when I'm in my emotions, that I am doing things that are actually helping the people around me and not inadvertently causing them more issues.
Let's say for a moment that she had stuck around, that she hadn't resigned, and she served out her term for the next 2 years. Do you think that your approach would have had an effect on the way she spoke about trans people, about the laws that she supported over the next 2 years?
So some of this, there's only so much I can do, right? It does require, any of this communication does require the person on the other side to be willing to participate and show up in some way, right? And she generally has been willing to show up and engage with me and have conversation with me. And so I think as long as that's going on, then it's worth it for me to continue to invest time and talk and grow and build that relationship and that connection. There's some mutual respect and understanding that we've had from the conversations that we had long before I started running. Interestingly enough, she's actually the reason that I got in the race in the first place. So in 2022, before the filing for that election season, I was at a town hall she was hosting, and we were talking about things like education and healthcare. And at the end of it, she said, you know, you've got a lot of really great ideas. Have you thought about running for office? And I said, I don't know if I'm sure that I want to run against you. And she said, well, go ahead, jump in the race. You should do it. And I was like, oh, this could be interesting, because maybe there's an opportunity here to model how to find common ground and how to work together to do that. And over the course of that campaign season, we did a number of events with Braver Angels, town halls, where we really started finding what is common across the political spectrum. What do we have in common? And I value those early conversations that we have and would want to find ways to continue to do that. Now, this kind of work going into conversations with somebody where there are some differences of opinion on things like the trans issues is really emotionally draining. It takes a lot of emotional energy. And so it's the work is not necessarily for everybody, or different people have different amounts of energy that they can put into it, maybe different levels, degrees of willingness. So I'm not necessarily advocating that everybody invest as much time and energy in this as I have with the most challenging person, but maybe you invest a little bit less time and energy, the amount that you can afford, with a family member or somebody else where it's worth it to you to build that deeper relationship, worth that investment. So there's a little bit of that, right? And I pay attention to myself to make sure that I'm not giving more than I can afford to give.
I think everybody deals to some degree with figuring out where their limit is. It sounds to me like you've acknowledged that your limit might be in a very different place than many people's, but I do assume it exists. Like, at what point in the rhetoric would you say, yeah, no, I can't give this person respect. I can't give them grace.
So this is, again, where the spiritual practice comes in. So I feel always called to learn how to see their humanity. And at some point I might say, there's not enough back and forth, give and take. This person is not willing to engage enough that it's worth it. And so at that point, then I might say, you know, it's better for me to go talk with somebody else instead.
You have two kids, and I imagine the conversations you have with them about these issues can be hard. Because, you know, on the one hand, I imagine they see and probably already appreciate, what will certainly as they become adults come to appreciate, this really beautiful example that you've given to them on how to give this radical grace. And then on the other hand, they will, if they have not already, hear people say really horrible things about trans people, about you. And they won't want to respond with respect and offerings of dignity for those people. So I got to imagine the conversations in your house have got to be fascinating.
Yeah, they really are fascinating. And my kids are learning, right? We've created a space where we're learning these methods and we're talking about what is effective. My 10-year-old is my family campaign manager, and my 14-year-old is my family graphic designer. And I've involved them in the campaign stuff. So we've had conversations, you know, around some of these conversations in particular as well that I've had with Representative Birkeland. And so I will turn to them. I will turn to my family campaign manager and say, hey, this situation came up. This is the topic that we're dealing with. How would you respond? And then my kids will do, as kids do, they will throw my words right back in my face and hold me to the standard that I'm trying to teach to them. Right? So it's this beautiful space of accountability where, again, if I expect my kids to act a certain way, then I need to make sure I'm willing to act that way as well and continue to model that. And if I can't model that, then I need to either say, hey, okay, maybe we need to make some adjustments to this approach, or here's another spot where there's room for me to improve.
That's Chris Campbell. He was the Democratic candidate for the election to the Utah House of Representatives to represent District 4. And he lost in that general election on November 5th, 2024. He's since volunteered as a candidate to replace Kara Berkland, who resigned shortly after the election. Chris Campbell, thank you.
Thank you.
Undisciplined is a production of Utah Public Radio. If you happen to live in Utah, you can listen to us on UPR every Thursday morning at 10:30. If you miss us then, you can listen to every episode of Undisciplined wherever you get your podcasts. Our program is supported by the College of Humanities and Social Sciences at Utah State University and from listeners like you. You can support our work at donate.nprstations.org/UPR. Our producer is Reagan Edelman. Our theme music is Little Idea by Benjamin Disseau. And I'm Matthew LaPlante. Thanks for listening. Now go have big ideas.